and welcome to the reading of Simplicity Parenting, the book by me, Kim John Payne, the author, with expanded comments just as we read, because it's been some time since this book was written and a lot of workshops, a lot of people have read the book, and we'll be unpacking a little bit more. This is chapter one, and this is the second reading in chapter one. So let's dig into the text. I sincerely believe that our instincts to protect our children will be what motivates us to change. Our impetus out of the pot will be our desire to protect our childhoods and their childhoods. Even as our own inner voices are silenced by the urgency and the obligations of so much stuff, our instincts as parents still give us pause. We do stop short occasionally or often, depending how speeded up our lives have become, and wonder how this pace is affecting them. Inner alarms are sounded when we confront the huge disconnect between how we believe childhood should be and how it has become. Such a moment happened to Canadian journalist Carl Honoré was the inspiration for his 2006 book In Praise of Slowness. The international slow movement is an amalgam of people and groups dedicated to controlling the pace of their lives, from the food they prepare to the cities they live in. An admitted speedaholic himself, Honoré got the idea for this book in just such a moment of great parental alarm. In an airport while travelling, Honoré saw a series of books called The 1 Minute Bedtime Stories. His first impulse was to buy the whole series and have it shipped immediately to his house. In that momentary flash, he was remembering the many times when he'd been reading to his 2-year-old son, "Read it again, Daddy," while thinking about the unanswered emails and other things he needed to do. The notion of a 1 minute story seemed perfect. Wouldn't a few of those each night do the trick? But fortunately, he had a follow-up thought, feeling just as quickly a sense of alarm and disgust that he, as with so many of us, had reached the point in our mad rush through life that this was even a thought. What was this saying and doing to our kids? The insight. We all have these moments of alarm, don't we? I know that I do. We're confronted with the often simple request of these small beings who we love immeasurably, and yet their pleas seem to be coming from a galaxy far away from the planet Slow. The 2 or 3-year-old asking the same story to be read again and again becomes an 8-year-old who wants to tell you the plot of a story in such remarkable detail that retelling will surely take longer than the movie itself. You've figured out a complicated carpool schedule that requires split-second timing but saves you a round trip or two per week. The whole enterprise grinds to a halt each morning around 2 laces that will not be tied, or 1 head of a hair that cannot be brushed, or a backpack that is always, but always, missing something. When I travel, I give talks. My children count on the time I am gone by sleeps. I find myself weighing my professional option in the same terms. How can I possibly do that workshop series that would mean being away for 5 sleeps? And here is one of these quite simplies that actually appear through the book. And it encapsulates much of what's been tried to be expressed in the chapter so far. So here is our first quite simply. Quite simply, by simplifying, we protect the environment for childhood's slow, essential unfolding of self. Perhaps I'll read that again. Quite simply, by simplifying, we protect the environment for childhood's slow, essential unfolding of self. now back into the text. The genesis for this book came with a professional sense of alarm, though my insight evolved more slowly than Henri's bookstore revelation. I'm sorry to say that it took me well over a decade to realize what I had been sensing for a long time. In my late 20s, in my birth country of Australia, I had completed my training with social services and was living near Melbourne. My house burned down, and along with many others in a 500-mile range. This happens all too frequently in Australia, and as a part of a disaster relief program, the government compensates homeowners with cash settlements. With my settlement, I decided to do volunteer work with children in Asia, and two refugee camps, one in Jakarta, one further north on the Thai-Cambodian border. In Jakarta, the camps were very large, populated by several hundred thousand people in various camps, who had been dispossessed by political instability. The camps operated a little like fiefdoms with feudal lords and gangs who would rule through nasty means, gathering loyalties with promises of protection from other thug lords. It was like a squalid shanty town or city. Really, the shelters were made of cardboard, bits of tin or plastic or whatever could be found. Everyone would walk on planks that were laid on the ground, keeping them slightly above the effluents and that would flow from drainage ditches and open sewers. The children I lived amongst and worked with were some of the most physically beautiful I'd ever seen. Some, most actually, had never known a different home of or life apart from the camp. Their lives were characterized by discomfort, illness, fear, and danger. There was little safety or leisure for these children. Survival was a family enterprise. As a people and as individuals, they'd suffered great losses. And sadly, the children were very clearly diagnosable with post-traumatic stress disorder. They were jumpy, nervous, hypervigilant, wary of anything novel or new. Many had adopted elaborate little rituals around everyday tasks, such as very specific, complicated ways of navigating the maze of the camp, which they imagined somehow would keep them safe. They were distrustful of new relationship, whether with adults or with peers, and had quite a few hair-trigger tempers. After leaving Asia, I moved to England, where I completed a training as a Waldorf teacher. And for years and years, I worked in school settings in private practice as a counsellor, seeing kids and making diagnoses of ADD, OCD, ODD. It came to seem like a sort of macabre waltz of the D's, an all too common dance these days, this fine carving up of our children. In the early 1990s, I was working in a school and had a private practice west of London. The children I worked with came from a variety of backgrounds, some British, some immigrants from lower classes to fairly affluent households. Some children I saw professionally were over-controlling in their behaviour towards their parents, their environment, even their play. Sleep and food were common areas of control. They might stop eating all but one or two foods or not go to sleep until late at night. Their anger was easily triggered, very often explosive, and parents would be at a loss to explain the reason for their outbursts. I was also seeing a lot of nervousness in these children. They would startle easily and have difficulty shaking it off or relaxing. They were also mistrustful of new situations, whether new material at school, new people in their lives, or any changes in plans or in their regular pattern of activity. I remember one boy who absolutely refused to go on holidays with his parents. He had never been to the beach before, and the prospect actually seemed to terrify him. What finally dawned on me was that the treatment plans I was developing for this group of children were identical to those I'd helped develop in Asia. When I looked at my work objectively, I could see no difference between my methods and goals with these children and those I'd been treating with children in Southeast Asia. What I was at last able to grasp was pretty remarkable. I doubted it for as long as I could until I was certain. These children were very typical children from an affluent country of the Western world, and yet they were showing the signs and symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. I'd been trained to associate PTSD with large wartime events. I think we all associate it with events of great magnitude. With life-changing traumas that leave their victims shaken in no small measure. My work over the last 20 years has taken me to many war-torn areas in Africa, Israel, Northern Ireland, as well as Russia and Hungary during and just after the period of perestroika. I didn't expect to find wartime children in this relatively affluent area in England, but sure enough, that's what I was finding. What struck me first were the similarities in the problematic behaviours adopted by these seemingly disparate group of children. After so many instances of clinical déjà vu, I couldn't ignore my instincts. Certain of the symptoms and behaviours, I was becoming more and more convinced of the cause. And as I looked more closely at their lives, I realised that for both groups, the sanctity of childhood had been breached. Adult life was flooding in unchecked. Privy to their parents' fears, drives, ambitions, and the very fast pace of their lives, the children were busy trying to construct their own boundaries, their own level of safety in behaviours that were ultimately unhelpful. These children were suffering from a different kind of war, the undeclared war on childhood. And here's another quite simply. Our society, with its pressures of too much, is waging an undeclared war on childhood. And there we'll leave this part of the second reading of chapter 1 today, leaving the text. And just a comment, again, since the writing of the book published in 2009, a number of years have gone by, and I'm seeing this tendency escalate more and more and more. This undeclared war on childhood has now been very strongly joined by marketing forces, which had always been there, but now the fight to gain brand loyalty for younger and younger children. Most advertisers realize that if you gain brand loyalty by around the age of two, that child, 2 years of age, right? That child will drive a Ford motor vehicle, eat a certain food, whatever it is. If you can do that. And so younger and younger and younger marketing forces are aiming at children. The speed of life in general is picking up more and more and more. And it seems that this sort of breaching of the barrier of childhood that I spoke about, it's almost like we're sandbagging, and we're now desperately, as parents, often sandbagging, pushing up higher and higher to try and hold this craziness in the world at bay. And really, I think that accounts partly for the countless numbers of hundreds of thousands of people who have joined the Simplicity Parenting community in an attempt to sensibly try and not so much sandbag out of desperation, but actually try and divert the waters that are flooding our families in the very first place. It's almost like life has become, it's become so ubiquitous, the speed of life has become so much the new normal, that for a long time we stopped sensing it. But now more and more and more, like I said, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people are sensing it and are looking for sensible ways to address it. So as we go further into the book, of course, we'll be exploring very specific, doable ways to address that. And we can hopefully look forward to that in future readings. Okay, thanks for now. Bye-bye.